The other thing we handed you is an advanced copy of the commission's biennial report, which will come back from the printer next week. And in the appendix to that, there's some text on performance results, but there's an appendix C at the back that goes through each of these 27 measures that are the new ones and gives you, in those categories where we have already been collecting that kind of results, it tells you what those results are. So we are fully committed, I guess I would say, as a department and our commission to a kind of the best possible, most accountable performance measurement system that, that we think is available. We did a lot of work in the interim to, with the help of the Progress Board, which I'd like to acknowledge, to investigate what other states and frankly other countries and areas were doing in this respect. And we think we've designed a system that will be not overly expensive to maintain, but will be one that keeps us accountable and keeps us focused on the legislature's statutory priorities for our department.
Thank you. Any questions? Thanks a lot. Having no one else testified, we'll close the public hearing. Senate Bill 274.
Mr. Chair, I move the dash one.
If there's one, wait a second, sir.
Oh, you're not there yet?
Yeah. Fourth session.
Oh, yeah, it is. Yes. The whole thing's a dash one.
Okay. Mr. Chair, I move the dash one amendment to Senate Bill 274.
Senator Gordon moves the dash one amendment to Senate Bill 274. Is there discussion on the motion? Objections? So ordered.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 274 as amended to the floor with the DuPass recommendation.
Senator Gordon moves Senate Bill 274 as amended to the floor with the DuPass recommendation. Discussion on the motion. You may not like it? Okay. Carrier.
Okay.
Senator Atkinson will carry the bill. Okay, close the work session on Senate Bill 274. Open a. Open a public hearing on Senate Bill 3. You're going to be shuffling some folders today, aren't you?
Yeah. No,
what did we do with 265? And we pulled it off. MLAC wasn't ready yet. Are you going to be combining all these other first things in 134 as well?
Not necessarily.
Oh, I thought everything was going into one big bill.
Well, we're still talking about that.
Well, consistency is the hobnob of the small mind.
That's another prophetic Irish statement, huh?
Actually, that came from Tom Horton.
Oh, okay. Mr. Cotman, go ahead.
Chairman, this bill is designed to take back to 1999 levels the fees that a private club has to pay for an on-premises liquor license.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Grover Simmons. I represent the Oregon State Elks Association. The purpose of Senate Bill 3 is to remedy a problem that came to my attention only after the close of the last legislative session. It deals with the Oregon Liquor Control Commission issuing a new kind of liquor license to private clubs and fraternal organizations such as the Oregon State Elks. This new license resulted in increasing the annual liquor license fee for 58 Elks Lodges throughout the state by a total of $11,000. The chronology of events which led up to Senate Bill 3 really started in 1997 when the legislature passed Senate Bill 300. That bill directed the Liquor Commission to form a task force, study alternative ways to existing alternatives to existing license structures and processes, and then advise the legislature on the merits of those alternatives. It's helpful, I believe, to know exactly what SB 300 said about the task force. And I'll quote a couple of sentences. The Oregon Liquor Control Commission shall develop a plan for simplifying the current licensing structure and process under ORS chapters 471 and 472. For the purpose of developing the plan, the commission shall establish a task force to study the alternatives to the existing licensing structure and process and provide advice to the commission on the relative merits of those alternatives. And this is the important sentence. The task force must include representatives of licensees and other persons who would be affected by changes of the licensing system. Close quote. The Oregon State Elks were not advised of the formation of the task force, nor asked to participate, even though we are substantially affected by the license changes which resulted from their work. The task force met six times in 1998, and their recommendations were approved by the Liquor Commission in June of 98, and then came to the legislature in 1999 as House Bill 2892. That House bill consolidated many licenses and eliminated 13 licenses, including the dispenser Class B license, which was the one that applied to private clubs. And that license was based on the size or the membership of the clubs. So we'll call that the old fee schedule. The old fee schedule was $100, $200, and $300, depending on the number of members in the private club. The new license is a flat $400, irrespective of the size. And the net result, as I mentioned earlier, is to increase the Elks' costs by $11,000 per year. Now, the staff of the Liquor Commission says that this whole thing is a mistake. It was an oversight and that they never intended to do anything to private clubs. They didn't say they were sorry, but they simply said it was an oversight, a mistake, and an unintended consequence. Mr. Paul Romain was on the task force, and he's present and available for discussion if that were helpful. And he was on the task force that came up with this new license structure. And he also says they had no intention of affecting private clubs. It was never discussed. SB 3 simply reinstates the license fee structure back to the $100, $200, and $300 level, depending on the number of members in the private club. In meeting with the OLCC staff quite a few times, it was my understanding all along that they did not oppose going back to the original structure. In fact, I even asked if they would introduce a bill under their own name to accomplish this result. And while they didn't want to do that, they did not oppose our doing it. So 2 days ago, I learned that they had changed their mind and now they want to keep the money. So in our opinion, since OLCC violated the 1997 law by not setting up the original task force in a proper way as required by the legislature, I believe they're in no position to stop the legislature from going back to the original license fee schedule for private clubs. For OLCC to support Senate Bill 3 would be fair and the honorable thing to do. I thank you very much for your time. Mr. Don Stevens is the other supporting witness from the Elks, and if he could testify now, I'd appreciate that.
Go ahead, please.
Well, at the risk of being repetitive, I'd like to add support to what Grover Simmons has already said. My name is Don Stevens, and I live at 17360 Southwest Thistlebrook Court in Durham, Oregon, and I'm a former mayor of that city. Today, however, I'm here to represent the Benevolent and Protective Order of Elks, as well as other fraternal and charitable organizations that serve alcoholic beverages to their members and their guests
under license from the Oregon Liquor Control Commission. Senate Bill 300 charged the OLCC to form a task force to study and revise the regulations and licensing procedures that govern the serving of alcoholic beverages in Oregon. The instructions to the OLCC reads, the task force must include representatives of licensees and other persons who would be affected by changes in the licensing system. And although we were the largest group of Class B licenses in Oregon, we were never invited to serve on that task force. House Bill, and they came up with House Bill 28, that task force did. House Bill 2892 contains some provisions that greatly affect us. The increase in the licensing fees is one of them. My lodge alone just paid a 400% increase in their license renewal. And the 58 lodges in Oregon will pay an additional $11,000 per year in license fees. And I don't know of any other class that was affected to that extent.
Mr. Stevens?
That's $11,000 per year that will not go for college scholarships, youth groups, or the Elk Children's Eye Clinic at Oregon Health Sciences University. But the major impact of House Bill 2892 and the fee system is that with a stroke of a pen, the OLCC has included all fraternal and charitable organizations such as ours into one class of license, a full on-premises sales license. This class of license places us in the same category as businesses who are open to the public, and it makes us subject to public accommodation laws, which has a great impact upon us. We have spent years and a lot of money defending our position that we are not places of public accommodation. We are not open to the public. Neither are we in competition with restaurants and bars who are open to the public. Our members may go to places that are open to the public just as anyone would. But people who are not members or guests cannot go to our places. But the language of the regulations does not speak to that issue. The new license seems to be one size fits all, and we strongly object to that. There must be some distinction in fees and language that separates us from places of public accommodation. And the failure to do so places us in the position of losing our tax-exempt status as charitable nonprofit organizations. This is not just an issue of license fees. This is an issue of putting charitable and fraternal organizations in a position of losing far more exemptions that enable us to perform charitable acts that no government agency could perform as economically or as well. In my opinion, the OLCC staff and the OLCC commission have acted very unprofessionally since the beginning. It started with Senate Bill 300. First, by leaving us out of the original task force, either intentionally or unintentionally, it doesn't matter. And two, by ignoring our testimony in open hearings. Three, by testifying in the same open hearings that it was not their intent to change our licensing structure. And fourth, by testifying in open hearings that they would not oppose our bill, Senate Bill 3. It's my understanding that the OLCC Commission cannot establish or change license fees or structures. Only the legislature can do that. And we are here to ask you to separate charitable and nonprofit licenses from general licenses, both in fee and description, for the reasons that I've stated. Thank you for listening to my testimony. I appreciate it.
Thank you. Questions? Thanks a lot. Linda Ignoski.
They're still talking to me. Good afternoon, Chairman, members of the committee. I'm Linda Ignoski. I'm the Regulatory Program Director for the Liquor Commission, and I'm here to give testimony opposing Senate Bill 3. Beginning in 1999 and wrapping up in 2000, OLCC consolidated many of the types of liquor licenses We went down from 37 licenses to 12. We did this in order to simplify and streamline the process of obtaining a license and creating a less confusing business for businesses and seeking a license and creating an administrative efficiency in our whole system. As you heard, I'm not going to go into the background of Task Force 300 since it was already mentioned to you. I would like to explain some of the how we came up with the composition of Task Force for Senate Bill 300. We have, at that time, we had about 13,000 licensees. If we looked at categories, we had at least 37 different types of licenses at that time. Looking at trying to put a task force that would be manageable, it was not conceivable to include every single type of license presentation, so we gathered a list of people, and I'd like to mention some of those, who we had on our task force. Sandy Hansen was our chairperson. Sarah Hackett represented the League of Cities. Mike McCallum represented the Oregon Restaurant Association. Bernie Justel, the chief of police of Progression. Linda Allard from Beaverton. Mary Botkins of the AFSCME Association. Steve McCoy, the Oregon Grocers Association industry. Paul Romain of the Oregon Beer and Wine Distributor Association. Steve Moore, who was a licensee. Marge Kafori, who represents the City of Portland. And Tina Wiltsey, a licensee. Pamela Erickson also served on that. Barbara Hutchinson, who was at that time a public affairs director, and myself. Katie Hilton, who was a licensed investigator, and Paul Romain. Given that, we had a big representation, and it was no intention to leave any one particular license group out, but try to make a task force that was reasonable in size. There is a difference in the licenses that we're talking about today. There is a difference between nonprofit, private clubs, and private clubs in general. Right now, we treat all private clubs, whether they're nonprofit or not, like the Arlington Club in Portland is a private club, but have a Class B license. They are not necessarily nonprofit, but this would also consume, if you reduce this would also allow them to have a reduced fee. The Loma Athletic Club may have a private license. I'm not sure about that. But so you're looking at, if you take private clubs in general, you are lowering it for all of them, not just private nonprofit organizations. Under the previous licensing system, private clubs that sold and dispensed alcohol beverages required to have a Class B dispenser license, and there were three different distinctions based on the size, and they either paid $100 a year, $200 a year, or $300 a year, depending on that size. After we consolidated our licenses, we put the private clubs with a group that we called on-premises, full on-premises licenses that have the same privileges under this license. The cost of this license is only $400 a year. This fee increase is naturally in statute. The OLCC's overall fee structure is set to provide parity among different types of license. Grouping all the licensed premises with the same privileges with one fee makes common sense, and it's administratively efficient. Rolling back fees for private clubs would upset this parity. It also might open the door for consideration of rolling back fees for other types of licenses because they do not feel their fee is fair. Prior to this year, the fees for licenses have not been raised since 1953. Some of our licenses have not been raised since 1933. In addition, the revenue collected from license fees does not come close to covering the cost to issue licenses and enforce liquor laws. We do not believe that $400 a year for private clubs is unreasonable. For example, the private club with a membership of 200, the fee would be $2 per year per member. For reasons of simplicity and fairness, the Oregon Liquor Control Commission opposes Senate Bill 3, and I thank you and be happy to answer any questions for you.
Thank you. Questions? Any Harper?
Former testimony ended at the private clubs didn't participate. How many private clubs are there in the state of Oregon?
I can't tell you that.
I mean, a dozen?
No, well, if you include, no, it's probably around 200, 300, maybe at the max.
Fairly significant number.
I think the majority of your private clubs are your fraternal organizations, which would be your Elks, Eagles, Moose, and those.
Or any other animal.
Let's see, did I leave out any?
You guys don't differentiate between profit and non-profit?
No, we don't.
Is there a reason why we don't do that?
We've never have.
Never have.
We never have. It's just been grouped under private clubs. And that would be a difference if we separated them out. That would be a difference than we ever have done before. They've always been treated on size, and it's kind of been geared, I think, towards a nonprofit because some of them are smaller. So that's why there was a fee difference. I think if you were less than 500 members, it was $100, and a thousand to a five, it was $200. And if you had over 1,500 members, it was like $300.
You made a statement that $400 is not that big of a deal. Have you ever run a private nonprofit club?
No, I haven't.
Well, how can you make that statement?
Well, we said it wasn't unreasonable.
How do you know it's not unreasonable if you've never been down there in the trenches?
I don't know.
Okay. You do have a... Senator, go ahead first.
Thank you. Just to get a little bit more information, and I appreciate your testimony. Are private clubs and fraternal organizations one and the same, so that there are 200 private clubs and fraternal organizations? Is that what you're saying, or are these two separate categories?
Chairman Byer, Senator Gordley, I can't give you an exact estimate, but we put private clubs all together, regardless if they're nonprofit or private profit.
Okay.
So I can't give you an exact figure. I didn't bring that with me. I'm sorry, I didn't.
Okay, I think I'm following what you're saying. Just another clarification. In the listing that you gave us of the work group, was there anyone on the work group representing the private clubs and or fraternal organizations?
Chairman Byer, Senator Gordley, not specifically, no.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Jack, go ahead, yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for your testimony. Did you, in your work group, distinguish between an organization like the Arlington Club, which, from my knowledge of the Arlington Club, they can't afford $400, and I think that is a fair statement, and a fraternal organization? Was there some sort of distinction made between those two organizations?
Chairman Byer, Senator Deckard, no, I mean, and it's true what the testimony before is, honestly, the conversation about how a consolidation would affect private clubs probably was not discussed at any length.
Mm-hmm. My only interest, Mr. Chair, would be to, that if we did move forward with this, that some distinction would be made between some private organizations, which by nature could afford this fee increase, I believe.
Okay. You also have a different type of license, a temporary license, correct?
Yes.
And you do make a distinction in that license by rule for nonprofits.
That's true, Chairman Meyer.
Okay. I don't have anyone else signed up to testify in this bill. We have written testimony submitted by the Eagles organization, Jack Kane, on behalf of the Eagle. The Moose Association. And so it should be in your packages. We'll close the public hearing on this bill. We don't have a fiscal statement yet. I think we're going to maybe do a little work on the bill. Wait for the fiscal, and it's obviously going to be at least $11,000 because that's what it's going to cost Elks alone. So we know that if we were to roll it back.
Is that all of the How do we know that?
Well, that was their testimony, that lacrosse ELPS organization, the 58 ELPS groups statewide, 11,000.
It is statewide, okay.
11,000 additional dollars.
Okay.
That's what their testimony was.
Mm-hmm.
So, a total of $11,000.
Mm-hmm.
So we know it would be at least that high, but in the 30,000 to 40,000 range, I would think. Yeah, there's. So anyway, we have to wait for fiscal before we can do anything. But I think we're definitely interested in working on this bill a little further,
mm-hmm.
and we'll bring it back at a later date. Thank you very much for coming forward today. Oops, don't want to do that.
Sure.
Close the public hearing if I haven't already. Now open it. Senator George is not here, is he? So okay. We'll now open a public hearing on Senate Bill 442.
Now this is Steve if it didn't see you.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman, this bill directs the Senior Disabled Services Division to pay the same rate for services provided in an adult foster home as it pays for those same services in an assisted living facility, and at the risk of giving the testimony that might come from a witness, these facilities establish for each of their patients a level of care, which in turn is based on the ability of that person to perform what are called activities of daily living. And the more help you need, the higher the level. There are five levels, and there is a difference, however, in how much an adult foster home gets for any given level and what an assisted living facility would get for that same level. This bill is to equalize it.
Okay. Committee, there should be a fiscal statement in your package on this bill. It has been issued, and it is shocking.
the bill also, Mr. Chairman, has a subsequent referral to Ways and Means, which seems appropriate under the circumstances.
What?
Yeah.
Mr. Simmons.
Wow. Well, the alternative is to lower everybody. Goodness gracious.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, again, for the record, my name is Grover Simmons. I represent the Adult Care Providers of Oregon. The problem which Senate Bill 442 addresses is that the Senior and Disabled Services Division will decline to increase the Medicaid reimbursement rate for a resident in an adult foster home, yet they will move that resident to an assisted living facility and substantially increase the Medicaid pay rate, sometimes as much as double. And conversely, SDSD will move a resident out of an assisted living facility into an adult foster home and cut the Medicaid reimbursement, again, sometimes by as much as one half. In both cases, SDSD refuses to increase the adult foster home provider's compensation for taking care of the same person. As might be expected, this generates a tremendous resentment among foster home providers who believe that their work is unappreciated and that they're not treated fairly. Equal pay for equal work is what Senate Bill 442 calls for. No dollar figures are incorporated in the bill, simply the principle and the statement of policy. Medicaid payments would be based on the level of impairment of the resident, irrespective of where that recipient is, in a private home or in an assisted living facility. I believe fairness and good judgment of good management of taxpayers' dollars supports this approach. The size of the building and how big the front lawn is would no longer be a controlling factor. The exact concept is incorporated in the governor's proposed budget. He has proposed a restructuring of the community-based pay rates to ensure that Medicaid pays the same amount for long-term care for clients with similar needs, regardless of the setting in which the client receives the care. If Governor Kitzhaber's budget were adopted, a single pay rate based on acuity and impairment would be implemented for clients receiving long-term care in licensed community establishments. According to the Senior and Disabled Services Division, quote, payment levels in assisted living facilities range from 7% to 57% higher than payment levels in foster homes and residential care, close quote. Under the governor's restructuring plan, this would be equalized, so the measurement or assessment of the level of impairment of Medicaid recipient would result in identical payments to either the adult foster home or to an assisted living facility. Right now, according to SDSD, the Medicaid rate for a level 5 resident in an assisted living facility is $665.63 per month higher than what an adult foster home would get for the taking care of the same individual. Now, in your packet, there's more information you ever wanted to know about this subject, but there is a table in there. This particular table, this is developed by Senior and Disabled Services Division quite some months ago. It shows the rates for adult foster homes level 1 through 5 and assisted living levels 1 through 5. And then the third section down here points out the differences. So if we're talking about a level 5 person, which is the most impaired resident in this table, the difference between a foster home and assisted living Medicaid reimbursement rate is shown down here in the third paragraph, $665.63 per month difference. That's the nature of the problem that we're talking about. Attached are, as I just mentioned, are the data illustrating this reimbursement problem. I've been working on this project for about 6 years, at least 6 years. But this is the first session where the governor or SDSD has formally adopted the same position. However, there's a big twist in this proposal which clearly needs explanation. Over the years, the goal of adult foster homes has been to raise our rates to be comparable with assisted living rates. But instead of doing that, the governor has proposed cutting the community-based care budget by $6.3 million. Instead of raising foster home rates to parity, he wants to cut the human resources budget pretty much across the board, including community-based pay rates. I believe strongly that much of the reduced funding for human resources will be replaced by the end of the session. The goal of adult foster homes today is to respectfully request your committee to endorse the principle of equal pay for equal work, pass Senate Bill 442, send it to Ways and Means so that we can take our chances in the final days of the session when it is finally known how much money will be available for the human resource projects. I thank you very much, Mr. Chairman, for your time in hearing Senate Bill 442.
Thank you.
May I also just put in the record a letter submitted by another foster home manager, just for the record, if I could do that.
Yeah. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Oops, I had the wrong list here. Yeah. Grover, did you bring anybody else in that wanted to speak specifically to it?
Room
full. I was afraid you were going to say that.
Can you pick one?
This is Earlene Berry, the president of the state association. She would be.
Okay, please, Earlene Berry. And I've got, looks like half a dozen other people signed up. Is it, would it be possible for
for all of you to summarize your statement very briefly when you come up, and unless you have something new to add that we haven't heard yet, you just indicate support and something like that. It would greatly speed up our process. Go ahead, please.
Chairman Beyer, committee members, my name is Earlene Berry. Thank you for the opportunity to come and testify before you today. I am an owner of 4 adult foster care homes in Eugene, Oregon. My address for the record is 1257 Calvin Street in Eugene. I have 10 years of experience with the adult foster care homes, and I'm very proud of my record and the hands-on care that I do in these homes. I'm president of the Adult Care Providers of Oregon, and I would just like for you to know that the adult foster care industry, or our adult foster care providers, represents 10,000 seniors and approximately 3,500 mental health clients that are also in the homes. There's developmentally disabled, and the veterans also are represented in the state in our adult foster care homes. I'm here to ask you to support this bill on the behalf of these providers that spend literally their life in giving care to the frail and elderly. I would like to open by giving you a story that depicts clearly the difference between the adult foster homes and assisted livings. I have a report from one of the providers that was asked to the ER room to come down and consider a placement for a resident that they had just had admitted to the emergency room. The doctor was very concerned about the present living condition that this lady was in. She had been found by her family on the floor in the bathroom in the assisted living facility. And because of the ring that was on her bottom, it was determined that she had been seated on the toilet for a period of 16 hours or more. This would encompass 3 shifts of caregivers, no ability to have had her meals, and certainly none of her medications that would have been due her in that time period. While this opportunity is there in the assisted living, it certainly is not something that we would that would not be a possibility in the adult foster care industry. The situation also came up in an educational setting where people were being trained. We are required 10 CEUs per year. A lady that was giving the class was very aware of a decubitus that was being described by a caregiver and asked for wound care instruction. The wound was of such a magnitude that she knew instantly where this person had been. They had been in an assisted living, and the decubitus had gone to a level 4, which is to the bone and open. It's very difficult for those to ever be healed if they ever do. That was why she was being removed from the assisted living place. I'm also aware of a situation at home where, and this would happen to me personally, a woman begged me to take her mother from an assisted living facility. She had dementia and didn't know how to get herself to bed, so she had been found several times sleeping on her bed or on the sofa, wet herself, and had been left there for all night. When the family had called to check on her, she had not had anything to eat, and this would be until about noon. This also goes to show the difference between the feasibility and the lack of care that's there for the frail elderly person with dementia in the isolation of an apartment in an assisted living home that could not possibly happen in the setting for adult foster care homes. The level of care that we're beginning to have to take on is a lot heavier in our homes simply because of the overbuild that's been happening in the industry. You'll find in my report to you, for the last 20 years, the adult foster homes have done a very remarkable job at providing care for these seniors and reducing the cost of care an enormous amount to the state. But in the last 2 years, we're beginning to suffer greatly because of the overbuild that's taking place by another setting that is virtually unregulated. The ORS 411-056-00118 states that a direct care staff facility shall have qualified staff significant in a number to meet the 24-hour scheduled and unscheduled needs of each resident and respond in emergency situations. This leaves a wide area for a judgment call, and that is not a feasibility in the adult foster cares we're regulated. We are definitely a 1 on 5 and perhaps even 2 and 3 on 5 depending on the care level of people that we're taking into our homes. Whenever a caregiver in an assisted living doesn't show up for work, the person who has already got approximately 30 people on their roster to take care of for the day is then given another higher number of people. This makes an extreme hardship on the seniors that are being taken care of. The hurried method in which they're handled in the facility is not conducive to dignity whatsoever in their care. even to the medications, if a medication, the person giving the med card for the day, if they are absent for the day, I have had their employees to tell me that, in fact, because they didn't know who the residents were, or because they didn't have time to give them, these medications are just literally being flushed. I have furnished you in the packet that I gave, and I'm hoping that got to you. There is one of the articles that's in there is for clarification for the classifications of levels, for levels of care. My reason for bringing that to you is because if you can imagine, or if you can get the picture between the difference of levels of care, in a level 2, which most of the adult foster homes are, these residents have needs for assistance in most all of their daily living activities, and they're dependent in no more than 3. This person can generate some very heavy levels of care, and you take that times maybe 4, and you're allowed 1 bed patient in that household. That's pretty heavy levels of care. So you have to know that what goes on in an adult foster home is some pretty heavy caregiving duties. If these same persons were in an assisted living where the care ratio is left undetermined and up to 30 to 50 a day, I guarantee you these people are not going to be receiving care as they should. I would like to give you a scenario of a level 2 person with a care ratio of 1 to 5. In our homes, most of us being level 2, many of us are now having to take on the high level 2, level 3, and even 4. Some of them, because they're registered nurses, are allowed to take on even the greater of care, and you'd probably hear that today. A person with a high level 2 would be incontinent, maybe perhaps bowel and bladder. They need to be toileted and diapered, and if you catch them, good, and if you don't, oh well, that means you've got another job to be doing for the day. They may be extremely heavy. They may be in a wheelchair. They may need to lift, transfer assistance for every time that they are moved from the bed to the wheelchair, to the toilet, to the dining room table, wherever they are. You may need special equipment and training, certainly, to be doing that. A person who has short-term memory loss and can't remember that they've asked you a question 5 minutes ago may repeat a question several times during the day and may need to be redirected throughout the day to accomplish activities. A person that needs assistance with their hygiene, they have arthritis to the degree that their shoulders are impaired and they can't raise their arms to be doing their hair or brush their teeth. So you're busy with feeding them because their hands are crippled and because they can't raise their arms. It's very important that you accomplish oral hygiene care. Maybe, and perhaps like with this person, deaf. Macular degeneration. there's a number, and because of death and because of macular degeneration, anxious because they can't see and can't hear, a habit of yelling to get attention in the household. So there's behavioral management that needs to be done. These people are not at a higher risk for being institutionalized. These are the people that we are actually taking care of in our homes. The adult foster care provider is handling very difficult care with the assistance of contract nurses, home health nurses, and hospice nurses. Yes, we are allowed even to keep people, the seniors in our home. I have accomplished hospice care for several of my residents whom I've allowed to age in place and keep until they passed away. The issue here is care, but also the fact that the adult foster care homes are wheelchair accessible. They have showers, step-in showers. They have private rooms. Yes, they have, some of them have semi-private rooms. But more importantly, what we do have here is that we're prepared to give the care. We provide a quicker response time and observation for symptoms, closer supervision, continuity to resolution of the elderly person's needs, and a better ratio of the caregiver to the resident. It's absolutely true that the medication assistance, personal care, and health monitoring is independent of the setting in which the service is provided. Paying higher care payments, especially paid with taxpayers' money, should never be justified because of the cost of the building. If the taxpayer and the senior are better served in the adult foster care home, there should be no difference in the pay given it to any facility, whether it costs $250,000, $800,000, or $8 million to own. The adult foster care have been providing these services, like I said, for 20 years since the FIG waiver. This October will be the 20-year anniversary of adult foster care or community-based settings. And like I said, only in the last 2 years have we really suffered the problems with the community-based care settings because of the overbuild of the assisted livings. We are also suffering almost to the point of critical need for caregivers in these institutions. When we have assisted livings, RCFs, adult foster care, in-home care, retirement centers, and we have two other medical communities, and there's an enormous need for the caregiver out there in this. And what actually is beginning to happen to us, we're finding that the people who are applying for the work generally come with a lot of baggage. They may be the ones who have not been able to get employment in here, and we're looking at people with criminal backgrounds and certainly less qualified caregivers for taking care of the elderly. This is what's happening to us in every aspect of the market. We do not have caregivers sufficient enough to be caring for the elderly. Certainly, we feel that we have been discriminated against. Whenever we're being paid 7 to 57% less for care than what the assisted livings are being paid, it certainly is discrimination against our homes and against the care that we provide. We're providing the heavier of care, but we're the ones who are receiving a lot less money for doing what we do. I would also like for you to know that there are several seniors that are providing care as a way of being able to stay in their own homes to other seniors that are less able than themselves. I take my hat off to them. It's a hard job. I give care, but if I were another 10 years older, I might be having a problem with the kind of workload that these people are actually having to deal with. It's the caregivers that support the comfort in life to the frail elderly and not the CEO or investors. We appreciate the concept of the assisted living. I would want you to know that we need all aspects to be able to accomplish care, but certainly we would like to be considered fairly in the marketplace with the other care settings. Just because we are the least paid, we are the least able to represent ourselves, we're the least known because we are unable to advertise concerning ourselves, this puts us at a disadvantage in the marketplace, and so we're coming to you today and asking for some equity in what we do. I'm hoping that you will support Senate Bill 442 for equal pay for equal work, and please consider the funding for this based on levels of care rather than on facilities. I thank you for the opportunity to testify. I had some other documentations that I wanted submitted into the records. I've also brought you my testimony that I submitted to the Mark Simmons Task Force.
We have the whole packet.
Okay. And if there are any questions, I would be willing to answer.
Thank you very much. Okay. At the other side of the other closing view, Julia Huddleston and Phyllis Rand, you want to come up together?
Chair Beyer and members of the committee, I'm Julia Huddleston. I manage the rate setting unit for Senior and Disabled Services Division. I'm here today to testify in opposition to Senate Bill 442. The funding on this legislation is not included in the governor's recommended budget. At present, as you've heard, SDSD does pay different long-term care providers using different rate systems. For clients with similar impairments, Medicaid service payments are significantly higher in assisted living facilities than they are in either adult foster homes or residential care facilities. The governor's recommended budget includes a rate restructuring proposal that moves adult foster care homes, residential care facilities, and assisted living facilities to the same reimbursement system. Reimbursement will be based on client need. Since the rate restructuring proposal is meant...
I'm confused. Now, this bill by itself doesn't set a rate. And you said it's not in the governor's budget, and then you said that you have equal rates in the governor's budget. Could you just help me out with that?
Sure. None of the SDSD rates are actually set statutorily. Rate-setting systems are defined in rule. Right now, in rule, we have the same rate-setting system for adult foster homes and residential care facilities and a different rate-setting system for assisted living facilities. In the governor's recommended budget, there's a rate restructuring proposal that requires us to move all three settings, adult foster homes, residential care, and assisted living, to a single rate-setting methodology and a single set of payments. We've made that assumption in costing that bill, that the proposal in the governor's recommended budget is carried.
Well, if I understand what you just said, this is in the governor's budget.
The rate restructuring proposal, there is a rate restructuring proposal in the governor's budget, Chair Beyer, Mr. Putnam. That rate restructuring proposal provides equity among provider types. It's different than what Senate Bill 442 asks for. Under Senate Bill 442, which has an emergency clause of July 1st, we would immediately on July 1st move only adult foster homes to the current assisted living facility payment schedule. The rate restructuring proposal in the governor's budget, pardon me?
Phases in.
It phases in. It begins January 1st. It also moves residential care facilities under the same payment system.
Senator Harper, you have a
question? 442 is already done.
Well, in the governor's budget, yeah, it gets phased in.
I accept that it was phased in.
Yeah, I believe that's correct. Correct me if I'm wrong, but doesn't it kind of do, rather than raising adult foster care, isn't it lowering assisted living rates?
Senator Beyer, Senator Harper, yes, that's correct. It raises slightly adult foster home rates and residential care facility rates. It significantly decreases assisted living facility rates.
It's equal.
It equalizes
it. Yes, it does.
Level one gets the same rate. Okay.
Yes.
Okay. Do you have more?
No, I don't.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I'm really glad she was here to answer those questions. I'm Phyllis Rand with the Governor's Commission on Senior Services, and I'm the legislative coordinator for the Governor's Commission. And the commission is in opposition with this bill because there's a fiscal impact, and we're concerned that the existing programs already in the division could be impacted by this $13.4 million cost. But I would like to share with you that the commission, of course, is concerned about the severe cuts in the governor's recommended budget. Those cuts not only eliminate the Medicaid survivability levels 15 through 17 and Oregon Project Independence, which serves 7,500 frail Oregonians, but abolishes positions like case managers, eligibility workers, and clerical staffs related to the former clients. Among the many less publicized cuts in the proposed SDSD budget is the elimination of 34 additional staff positions. With clients and staff cuts already on the line, regardless of the perceived merits of Senate Bill 442, the commission believes the committee would be ill-advised to recommend passage of a bill that will create another $13.4 million hole in the 2001-2003 budget.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. You're welcome.
Julia, just a point of clarification. This bill does not mandate that adult foster care rates be raised, does it? It just says they're going to be the same.
No, it doesn't require that they be raised. It does just say they're going to be the same.
Okay. Make sure I was clear what the bill did. Thank you.
Yeah.
Lisa Nuss and David, is it Parrett? Parrett? Once again, we've heard pretty good testimony on both sides already, so if we could limit it to new information, it would be very helpful to us.
Sure, and we'll try to be brief, although this will be new information. My name is Lisa Ness. I'm the Legislative Director for the Oregon Alliance of Senior and Health Services. We're the statewide nonprofit association of nursing homes, assisted living facilities, and retirement housing. She's passing around a letter I gave to your offices yesterday, but I brought another copy today in case it didn't get in your bill file. And just briefly, it calls your attention to several significant differences between the regulation requirements for adult foster homes and assisted living facilities. The first grouping reviews some of the significant physical differences, which David will go over a little bit also. Individual apartments, accessible private baths, individual food preparation, individual temperature controls, these are all prescribed by administrative rule. In the nursing and the service, assisted living facilities have to provide 24-hour, what they call awake staff, that's awake and available to residents, stricter administrator qualifications, higher levels of staff training, a full kitchen and dietary needs, the list goes on. This is just an example. I've talked with Grover Simmons before. When he introduced the bill, he explained to me it was before the governor's budget cuts came out, and his intention was to increase the payment level for his clients, and we certainly understand that. But if the question is the Medicaid reimbursement level too low, the answer is yes, but it's low across the board for all facilities. And in fact, we're having those discussions right now with the Ways and Means Human Services Subcommittee members and with some of you already, and we'll get around to the rest of you if we haven't, on the governor's Medicaid cuts across the board to community-based care like assisted living. Briefly, I won't respond to some of the assertions that were made about care in assisted living facilities, but I feel a need to just object to them inaccurate and I would say a little bit inappropriate. There are about 40 assisted living facilities that are members of the Alliance. They're all nonprofits. Many of them are under a mission to care for their community, and they've been doing it for decades. There's the Benedictine Home in Senator Byer's district, and the Baptist Manor in Senator Gordley's district is looking to add an assisted living facility, and those folks take pride in the quality of their care, as they rightfully should. I would like to turn it over to one of our providers, David Parrott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Senate members. I too is really pleased to be here today, and I want to be talking a little bit about Dallas Retirement Village. Again, my name is David Parrott. I'm the executive director of the retirement community there, which has been in existence since 1947. The purpose of my testimony before you today is to express concern and a recommendation for a no vote in the Senate Bill 442. Not, again, because adult foster homes are undeserving of a higher reimbursement through Medicaid, but because the premise of the bill is flawed and ambiguous. On the surface, it seems like a good idea to pay providers equally for similar resident impairment levels. Equal pay for equal work is what I think I heard today. One could make the same argument that nursing homes be paid equally with acute hospitals, because at times there is care for residents with the same impairment levels. One could also say that assisted living facilities should be paid the same as nursing homes, again, because there are residents there that may have similar impairment levels at times. The problem with this argument is that while there are many or some patients and residents who have similar impairment levels, each progressively higher level of care has a more stringent set of requirements and regulations that serve a very important purpose. Each level of care, whether it be acute hospital, assisted living, nursing homes, or adult foster homes, serve a specific purpose and have separate set of rules and standards and regulations. To accept the argument that adult foster homes be paid equally with assisted living facilities, you must agree that assisted living facilities be paid equally with nursing homes and so on. Assisted living facilities have greater physical plant and staffing requirements than do adult foster homes. Assisted living facilities are required to provide independent apartments, and I won't go over again what was already stated by Lisa. What I'd like to leave you with is, while I do agree that adult foster homes and assisted living facilities and each of us in nursing homes deserve a higher reimbursement from Medicaid, and I do oppose the governor's budget to reduce reduce the assisted living facility budgets and also not to raise the Medicaid rate for nursing homes, this legislation or this bill does not address and does not answer that problem. I respectfully request for you to vote no on this, and I thank you for your consideration.
Thank you.
I have a technical question for you. I used to know something about this business, and to me, an assisted living facility was not the same as a nursing home. That's just the vocabulary we use. But this bill says an assisted living facility is any physical structure licensed by the Senior Disabled Service Division in which a range of individualized supportive personal and health services are available on a 24-hour basis. To me, that language includes nursing homes.
Okay.
It would not include hospitals because they're licensed elsewhere.
The language there in the bill itself, that is not clear, because there is a difference. Each level, whether it be assisted living facility or a nursing home, do provide 24-hour care or assistance. But there are very specific requirement differences between a nursing home and an assisted living facility for staffing levels, for levels of professional care, and multitude of other items that distinguish the difference between the two levels.
All right, Mr. Chairman, just one more question then. I have not looked at the governor's budget. When it equalizes the pay between adult foster home and assisted living facilities, does that equalization include or exclude this definition of assisted living facility? In other words, is he equalizing the rate for nursing homes?
Mr. Chair and Mr. Putman, I do not believe that's what the intent there is. This is to equalize the care in adult foster care, residential care facilities, and assisted living facilities. The nursing home is separate.
The narrow definition of assisted living facility. Thank you.
Yes.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay, is it Joan? And I'm trying to read. Is it Lisa? Joan? Lisa Yankee and Joan Gallup?
Gallup.
Okay.
The sweetest we can mess up is the better the name.
Thank you, and if you have written testimony, please turn it in, and again, be brief as you possibly can be.
Chairman and committee members, my name is Joan Gallagly. I'm a owner-operator of an adult foster home in Multnomah County, and I'm here to testify for Bill, Senate Bill 444. I received a resident in my home who has a story to tell. She came from assisted living facility. Her rate there was $4,000. On top of this rate, she had to pay her own tissue, toilet tissue, Kleenex, laundry soap, hair care products, and bathing products. When she came to my home, the rate was cut to $1,043. I have to provide all of the things she was paying for unless she doesn't like the products I use. She also told me that it was difficult to get her help when she needed, often waiting hours to get response to her calls for help. She has an inhaler, which is very important, as she has bad asthma attacks. In those last few days of the facility, she was not given much help at all because they knew she was leaving. Before she agreed to leave, she was shown a room which she thought she liked. When it came time to move into the room, she was given one that was barely able to fit her bed, let alone any of her personal belongings. This upset her and her family, so they placed her in my home. There was an article in the Oregonian on Sunday. It told about assisted living facilities that take Alzheimer's. There are four in Washington and Oregon, two in Washington, two in Oregon. Their rates start at $2,800. And if you want a private room, you have to pay an extra $800. That is three times what an adult foster home gets, and we do take Alzheimer's. And I included the article that was in there. I also have written testimony. Do you want me to do it or just submit it?
Just submit it, please.
Okay.
Thank you.
From another provider.
Lisa?
Thank you.
Chairman, committee members, my name is Lisa Yankee. I'm also an owner-operator of an adult foster care home in Multnomah County. I'm here to give testimony in favor of Senate Bill 442. I feel I need to kind of summarize and be brief.
That'd be very helpful.
It is true that in the last, in my experience, 5 years, adult foster cares are required. If you want the placement of the client to take on greater care needs, to do more for the clients, we are required to be there whether we are awake or not. We have monitors in the more significant care where the client's needs are greater. We have monitors to alert us, you know, when they need us. I can only comment on my home, the experience of having a client that I did a thorough assessment with the family members, with the case manager, with the doctor's assistant to find out all the needs of the client. The client was in my home 2 months. No progressive diseases were noted in the assessment, no dementia, things like this. After she was placed there, I found out that she had Parkinson's disease. Also, she has dementia and severe behavioral problems, which causes me to need greater staff. I was getting a fairly low Medicaid reimbursement rate. The total, I believe, for the client was $1,200. That's with her private room and board portion and the Medicaid reimbursement rate. After speaking, you know, with the case manager, a year later, I did get an adequate reimbursement rate after submitting lots of documentation showing what I had to pay a care provider to be there at night, showing what my ongoing costs were that were actually higher than what I was making on the client per month. The bottom line is we have a very difficult job also. We obviously care about the work we do, or we wouldn't be doing it. That's our choice. And we just want to be paid fairly for the work we do, taking care of their impairments.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay, we've got Gary Lane and Annie Elkins, and I'm sorry, I can't even get close on this next name.
You can call up the phone number.
How about a 661-2930? Does that phone number ring a bell? Thank you. Again, please, and before you start, I can see we are going to run out of time before we get to Senate Bill 357, 358, 359, and 360. So if anybody's here for those four bills, feel free to know that we're not going to get to them. And Senate Bill 714 we'll only do if Senator George comes in, and it doesn't appear he's going to come in to talk about his bill because he's also working on amendments. So anyone here for any of those bills, we won't get to those today. Thank you very much. Go ahead, get started.
I'm Gary Lane, and I live in Eugene, Oregon. I take care of state placed clients only, and they're all adult schizophrenics. The reason I chose to do this, I have a brother who's schizophrenic and has lived in abysmal housing in Southern California. As I start to look at the economics of the situation, I found that under Oregon labor law, the current minimum wage is $6.50 per hour. I provide around-the-clock care for five adult schizophrenics. If you add up the payments for service pay, where my pay scale, it varies between, let's say, 700, perhaps up to 900 if you have an incredibly difficult case. But if you start at the standard pay of average, let's say, $800 a month, you're going to, when you have five of them, you end up with Oregon paying $820 a month less than the minimum wage. And in my opinion, I think that Oregon ought to be paying the same minimum wage that they demand of all other employers. If I go to hire someone to substitute care for me, I end up paying out more money than I earn for that period of time by $52.80. So if I'm gone for 2 days out of a month, it costs me not only the amount of money it takes to drive somewhere, visit a relative, have them feed me, but I have to pay $52 more than I earn. And that's basically why I'm here, is to make people aware that the remuneration rate for Medicaid patients is less than what we mandate as Oregon citizens for all employers to pay except Oregon. I would like to have you consider, providing minimum wages for those who care for your parents, for those who care for those who are genetically disabled. I love my residents. I want to remain a foster care provider without having to find a new wife who has more money so that she can help subsidize the state of Oregon to care for other people. And that's basically my case.
Thank you.
Well, if he does, he can run for legislature.
I'm thinking about it.
Go ahead.
Hi, my name is Annie Elkins, and I feel more like I do now than when I came in. I've never done this before, so please excuse me if I say the wrong names the wrong way.
I don't know that. We're pretty informal.
Okay. I've been a nurse in geriatrics since 1967. I've been aware of all the changes that started and have continued, where now that they have completely overregulated nursing homes, so they've turned into what they are today. Adult foster care homes, I thought Oregon learned a long time ago with Fairview that this is the way of the future. You cannot take care of a large group of people in a large facility. It's undoneable. You can't do it. You need to downsize, and we have one caregiver per five clients. That's a law. We have to have that. And sometimes we have more because we have couples working in the home. Depending on their needs, we're hiring private caregivers to come in. So the care ratio that they're getting is just, and the care that they're getting, they're not getting any bed sores. They're not getting any skin rashes. The medications have gone way down because they are being redirected, and they don't have to be medicated to the point of zombies. In order to make it in a nursing home, they have to medicate them to shut them up, They don't have time to take care of them. I was a charge nurse in nursing homes for 29 years. I know of where I speak. Okay? It's a shame. Adult foster care is the wave of the future. Think of what the alternative would be. Nursing homes? This is what you want your parents? Okay, so adult foster care homes run by people like us. It's not a mom and pop business anymore. We are giving professional care to the elderly that need us the most. We have home health come in. We can take care of anything a nursing home can take care of, other than we can do G-tube feedings. We can do oxygen. We can do anything. But we need to be paid for what we do. If you take them out of assisted living and put them into adult foster care homes, your costs will go way down. Your medication costs will go down, the treatment of all the sores and things they get. I got one gentleman from assisted living who almost died. Guess what he died from? Almost. Constipation. They do not regulate them. They do not even go in there and see if they've had anything done that day. I had a lady come out of an assisted living. Her meds were supposed to be given, and the daughter had to pay $300 more a month to have the medications given to her mother. Every night she went in there, and there they sat on her nightstand, not given to her once. She goes in at night, and her mother's light is not on. She's sitting in the dark. Her mother calls her one night, tells her she's on the floor. So she calls the home and tells her, my mother's on the floor. Half an hour later, her mother's still on the floor. She calls the facility back. Oh, well, that was Laura. She went home. Could you imagine? There would be nobody could lay on the floor that long in an adult foster care home. Right now, I have 4 vacancies. I have 3 homes. This is such a big physical impact on me, at the fact that I know what my business is not supporting me at this time. Not me at all, just the business. So we have to do something. I believe that Medicaid should go to the best of homes in our area, not to the worst, to the people who can't speak English, to the ones who do the very bad jobs. We should be vying for Medicaid contracts and getting them and giving them the best of care. That's the way Medicaid should work. Because sometimes some of us might lose our money, and we might end up on Medicaid, and people are getting older and living longer every day.
Thank you very much.
Mr. Chair, just a thought on the ability to speak English. I would just beg to differ that we just have a wide variety of dialects spoken, and that wouldn't be, for me, the criteria. And we don't have to debate that. I just wanted to throw that out there.
Thank you. And I have to know, what's your name?
My name is Karen Campbell.
Thank you,
Senator, for your time. I'm here to share 2 case studies with you. I'm an adult foster home owner-operator. I live on my site. I've been in the long-term care system for 20 years, as well as owned and operated my adult foster home before licensing existed. I sat on the board to help develop the licensing and the program to ensure safety and quality of life for our elderly folks in our long-term care. I have 2 quick case studies. I will not burden you with time here. A gentleman came to me from assisted living as a 52-year-old man, a NASA aeronautical engineer who suffered a stroke, came into my home at 70-plus, maybe 90 pounds. We couldn't get an accurate weight. Came into my home. He was in my home for 5 years. He left my home because his monies ran out. At that point, I carried that man financially for a period of 2 months, waiting for the state to decide what kind of reimbursement they would give me for his care. We have 7.34 an hour a day times 2 caregivers of tactile care for this gentleman. He was aphasic. He could not swallow. He was on a feeding tube. He had a Foley catheter and oftentimes a CAD pack running for IVs. He was a level 3 according to our statutes, but he is also a young man who needed a quality of life. He was removed from my home based on the fact that I could not afford to accept the rate. His cost for my home ran me $4,100 a month to maintain him at the tactile care of 7.75 hours a day. His rate was $4,100. I asked the state to consider that. They asked me to prepare a graft of his day by the minute. I'm talking a 2-minute blood pressure. I kept track of a month and added up per minute, per second, what it took to take care of this gentleman. I did so, waiting this two-month period of time. They declined me and turned around and offered me $1,700. I couldn't even cover the turning cost of this man who required turning every half hour. They thus, in fact, turned and put him into a nursing home for $9,200 a month. I have a problem with that. That is not even cost-effective. That is not even fair. Nor did they consider the attachment that I had grown to love this man, my staff had grown to, the other residents, and the family that we had worked so closely with had grown accustomed to this level of care. He went into this nursing home, better known as a SNF, and when I was called by the family at 10 o'clock at night to please go visit this gentleman, he was again in a fetal position and down to 110 pounds. He gained to 190 and stood independently in a standing frame in my home. I ask that you consider the quality of care versus the ratio. The ratio in my home is 2 to 5, up staff 24 hours a day. At night, we have 4 people in the house able to evacuate. And still, my husband has to work a second job to help us substantiate the funds of our home. Please consider Senate Bill 442. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. One more. Jim Carlson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Jim Carlson, representing the Oregon Healthcare Association. I'll try to be brief and get to a few things that haven't been discussed yet. First off, though, I'd like to say that I've had great occasion to come across and deal with many caregivers across the spectrum in long-term care throughout the state of Oregon, and have been in all care settings, from foster care homes through residential care, assisted living, and skilled nursing facilities. And I would like to say that I have found caregivers to be very committed, very concerned, and very mission-driven for the most part on providing these services. And I really appreciate the comments from the gentleman who testified earlier about the state of Oregon's not even paying a minimum wage for the care and services that are provided across our long-term care spectrum. When you break it down on an hourly basis, even for skilled nursing facility care in Oregon under our Medicaid system, we're paying $4.06 an hour. My 12-year-old daughter gets paid more for that for babysitting in our neighborhood and doesn't have to provide nearly the range of complex medical, housing, room and board, and other services. We have been very concerned about the inadequacy of Medicaid rates across the whole spectrum for a number of years now, and our goal has been to bring the bottom up, not to bring the top down. And I think when Mr. Simmons referenced the big twist, so to speak, in the budget proposals we're facing this session, where we're seeing some dramatic funding reductions to a system that's already chronically underfunded and has been underfunded, I think, to a large extent for decades now, it's one of the reasons why we're so concerned about a lot of what we're seeing in the budget. I do not want to impugn the motives of any of the folks who have testified earlier today, but I would like to respond just and say that there have been a lot of very serious charges and accusations and anecdotal stories told that I don't think are particularly constructive to the policy issue at hand here, which is ultimately seeing what we need to do to make sure we can provide absolutely the best care, services, and quality of life for seniors and people with disabilities in this state. And part of that is one size does not fit all. Consumers, seniors, people with disabilities have a range of choices and options in the Oregon system. And that's one of the greatest strengths we have in the Oregon system, is that some people prefer a private living apartment unit, some people prefer a smaller foster care setting, some people require a skilled nursing facility level of care, services that can only be met in that setting. There are some things of a factual nature that have not been discussed here today that I think is important when you start looking at payment system and rate setting issues. One of them is that foster care homes, you enjoy some unique exemptions under Oregon law that other long-term care licensed facilities do not enjoy. and I'm referencing this chart in my testimony, taxation of Medicaid service payments, for example, foster care homes are exempt on taxation of Medicaid service payments, whereas a residential care facility, an assisted living facility, or for that matter, a nursing facility, have to pay taxes, both state and federal. And when you look at the chart on the front, for every net dollar in Medicaid income, a residential care facility, for example, will only receive 71 cents compared to a full dollar for a foster care provider. I still think foster care homes are reimbursed too low, just like I still think the other settings are reimbursed too low, but I think that's an important factual distinction to point out. Another one is workers' compensation coverage for employees. Adult foster care homes in Oregon are exempt from having to provide workers' compensation coverage for their employees. And obviously that's not the case in the other licensed care settings. And as I think many of you are aware, workers' compensation premiums can be a very high cost, overhead cost, particularly when you're dealing with healthcare workers who are doing lots of lifting and transferring and other types of jobs where there are a significant number of work-related injuries. Nursing services is another interesting distinction. For contract RN services for Medicaid clients who need nursing assessment or nurse delegation or assignment, SDSC pays for the contract nurse to provide those services. If you're in a residential care facility who's reimbursed at the same payment level as a foster care home, or if you're in an assisted living facility, you must have a regularly scheduled RN or LPN with RN supervision available either on your staff or through contract, and you have to pay those costs directly as a provider. The state does not pay for those services in those settings. We already heard some discussion about the state minimum wage. Foster care homes, once again, are exempt from the state minimum wage, whereas other care settings are not. State wage and hour laws, I'm not talking about federal minimum wage here. There's a distinction under the law here between state minimum wage and federal minimum wage. They are subject under federal, but not under state, which is much higher than the federal. State wage and hour laws, once again, there's a distinction here between federal laws that they're subject to and state laws that they are exempt from. And once again, the final one is on a lot of state-mandated other standards, and some of these get to building and physical plant, others get to things that are really dictated in the state's licensure requirements for the different settings that add substantially to cost structures. We've had discussions, I know the chair and I have had discussions and others have had discussions around some of these issues. This is not a simple issue. There are a lot of complex factors here. I think the bottom line is that the services foster care homes provide, the services assisted living facilities provide, residential care facilities and nursing facilities are very important to the individuals who are dependent on those services, to their families, to their communities. And we need to be working on ways to bring the bottom up and to start doing some planning in this state on how we're going to meet the needs of a rapidly aging population that's going to almost double in the next 20 years. And if we are having problems in this biennium, even maintaining continuing service levels of funding for these programs, we need to have a strategic plan as a state on how we're going to adequately meet the needs of our population when the population is going to be twice as large in the coming years. I want to thank you for your attention to this matter, and I'd be happy to respond to any questions.
Thank you, Jim. Thank you very much. Thank you, everyone, for coming in today. We'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 442. Did you find the amendment where you were? Okay. All right. We are going to a work session on Senate Bill 427. Open work session. 427? We heard this bill before. This is the one that changes, or we clarify that 6 months means 6 months when people are becoming eligible for PERS benefits. Anybody like it? And,
Mr. Chair, I'll move Senate Bill 427 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Thank you. Senator Harper moves Senate Bill 427 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any other discussion on the bill? Any objections to the bill? The motion, excuse me. So ordered. Corcoran is absent, apparently. Okay, you want to carry it?
I'd be delighted.
Senator Harper wants to carry the bill.
Say how excited I am.
Close the work session on Bill 427. And we're going to do one more quick public hearing on the House Bill 2701. Open a public hearing. Mr. Putman, brief.
Mr. Chairman, 2701 requires certain disclosures of how financing is given sellers of manufactured homes in a mobile home park. It's my understanding that there's some concern that the way the bill is written right now, there's some question about whether it has some retroactive aspects. Not being an attorney, I can't speak to that, but that has been brought to my attention. It came out of the House, I believe, 54-0.
Thank you. Don?
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Don Miner. I'm here on behalf of Oregon Manufactured Housing Association to speak in support of this legislation. The bill is being proposed by ourselves and by the OSTA folks, the Organization of Consumers of Manufactured Homes Who Live in Parks. Over the last year or so, the industry has come under a great deal of scrutiny and criticism in the Oregonian, and we don't agree with all of the criticisms, but we think that much of it was well-founded, and we want to address those concerns, and this is one of the measures that we have brought forward to address those issues. Many dealers, or some dealers in the past, have been financing rent when they sold a manufactured home that was going into a park. It was either built into the purchase price, or it was built into the loan, or the dealer paid it, or somehow the consumer was not held responsible for paying that rent for the first year, or in some cases a longer period. This practice was intended to give purchasers of new manufactured homes sort of a breather. I don't know if, when you buy a new home, you have a lot of costs, new furniture, lawnmowers, lawn furniture, et cetera. And it was hoped that this would help ease, particularly first-time home buyers, into home ownership. Hasn't worked out as we had hoped. Rather than using that grace period to save up money and become prepared to begin paying rent, oftentimes folks either got out of the habit or they went out and took on other debt, thought they had extra money laying around. And in many cases, then, when the rent becomes due, some of these folks have defaulted. They just walked away from their homes. It has created a lot of dislocation in the marketplace. Some consumers, park owners, and lenders have said that they were unaware that this had occurred. Now, it's sort of hard to, without going there. What we're trying to do is answer the concerns and to deal with the problem. What this measure will do is require that if the seller of the home, and by the way, seller will only be dealers, so it won't apply to individuals selling their own home, but if a dealer sells a home, he's going to be required to give a written disclosure that either the seller has paid the rent or that rent was financed as part of the purchase of the home. And this notice must be provided by certified mail to the purchaser, the park owner, and the lender, if any. And the notice must include both the amount of rent that has been paid or financed and the duration of the rent. This measure does not prohibit the practice, but just shines a light on it and lets folks know what's going on. If people still want to engage in the transaction, they would be free to. However, it is our expectation that the practice will go away. It's just had such bad consequences in the marketplace that we don't expect that it will continue, or at least not very widespread. Mr. Putnam did point out a concern that we see this legislation applying prospectively. However, when you read it, at least there's somebody could make the argument, well, I know the home that came in 2 years ago had rent in it, no one told me, and bring a claim. So what we would hope is to have an amendment by your work session, if possible, that would just make clear that it only applies to transactions occurring after the date of the measure.
Okay, well, by that statement, I assume that you don't want a work session right now.
Well, unless you could adopt a conceptual amendment.
What's the problem? This thing wouldn't be effective until such a date.
Well, I think the issue is whether or not someone could use this bill to come back and file a claim against the bank or someone saying, I bought my house 2 years ago, but I wasn't told.
And there's a free rent portion.
It's a stretch, but if we need to clarify it a little bit.
Yeah, that's
what the Supreme Court told me. Mm-hmm.
So. Okay, thanks, John.
Thanks, sir.
Any questions before we
put him over out
of the way? Thank you. We'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 2701 and ask Mr. Putman to go have an amendment drafted to clarify that this is not retroactive, it only is for the future. With that, committee members, Senator George never came over to talk about his bill, Senate 714. He is in discussions with the lottery on it and trying to get amendments drafted, so we won't go there today. The rest of these are all on Monday's agenda, I believe, and seems how it's Friday afternoon at 4:45. We're adjourned.